Maybe try to hide.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right. It's about the crux of this is our beliefs and our values, which is why I think the paperwork. So what we believe and what is real is almost never the same. And we'll get into the reasons why that happens and how that happens throughout this session today. So it's really interesting and important that we take the opportunity to understand more about beliefs. But if we want to make it, if we want to create some change around around our life, or we want to re-record. So reframe how we feel about certain events that happen to us in our life, we need to take action. When we take action, we are free to be who we choose to be. Taking action is key. Not easy, but it is key. So just so that we're aware, so where we've been so far, in the first 4 weeks, we cover the Enneagram, charismatics, the controllers, the harmonizers, and the intuitors. Then in August, we covered the six core human needs and relationships. Today, we're covering clearing shadows and blind spots. In October next month, we're going to be covering personal power and living with your passion and purpose. And then, of course, we have the retreat at Wamberal in November. So that's where we have been so far and where we're going. So again, I want to congratulate you for being here because you're showing by being here that you are committed to being the best version of you. There are so many more positive resources coming your way over this next few months. It's amazing. And I just want you to be able to enjoy being here, enjoy the learning, enjoy the new skill set you're going to have, because it's not only just for you, it's also for the people who are close to you in your life. It's important that we understand that. So last month we talked about the ideal relationship. And the ideal relationship, we need to be lovers. We need to be a mother, father, or parenting. If we don't have children, that parenting can be of a pet, or it can be of, a house renovation, or it can be travel. Well, it doesn't matter, but it's something you're doing together outside of anything else. And we need to be best friends. So I discussed that with you all last month, and I'm gonna continue with that today before we get into clearing shadows. We also covered some of the questions that are important for us to ask ourselves. So, what is your relationship? How does your relationship impact what's happening in your life? And the quality of your relationship dictates your health, your wealth, and your overall well-being. You want to be sharing your dreams and visions with that one that's closest to you, excuse me, whilst aligning your goals, but at the same time, staying true to you. Don't get caught up with, doing things that the other person wants. It has to be, both of you. How do you share and care for others? Are you taking care of you? Are you staying true to who you are and your needs? What do you need without getting lost in the other person? How do you keep the passion alive and communicate your own needs effectively? How do you get what you want when you want it? Some really great questions. So also in the last few weeks, we have talked about the six core human needs. I sent you the questionnaire. I only have one back so far, but I believe that we are going to be getting more of those, which is will be great for you. Doesn't matter to me, but in order for you to get the best possible value out of this spring retreat, I recommend that you continue on with that questionnaire about the values and the six core needs, and also the questionnaire about relationships. It's up to you. Whatever you want to do is fine. So if you haven't already done it, I suggest you do. It will be a great thing for you to do that. I'm so sorry. I keep coughing. So what have you done with them? It's really important. Like everything that I offer you, it's optional. So all four of you are here, which is great. We've got one more to come, I think. So who else have I got here whilst we're here? Lee's here. Well done, Lee. Thank you for being here. And I don't know who else is here. Anyway, I'll just keep going. So like everything I offer you, it's optional. Completing this questionnaires is you acknowledging that you're building a new pathway. A new pathway moving forward to a full release at the retreat and beyond. I want you to consider what you really want from your retreat. Know that everything you do from now on is you validating you and your commitment to self. If you want to move forward to a life that you want and so deserve, then this is the place to start. So let's talk very briefly about the three human dimensions, the body, mind, and spirit. Every physical action we take is a result of our thoughts, our emotions, and our beliefs. Often, our physical selves, or our body, is trying to tell us something that we may not be aware of. With the mind, we know that the struggles we face in our lives, I need to tell you, they're illusions. They seem very real. They are nothing more than our own creations. And I'm going to explain that to you as time goes by. I'm going to repeat that. The struggles we face in our lives are illusions. They're not real. They feel very real. But they are your own creations based on your past life. Our minds are really powerful. And what we believe to be true becomes our reality. If we believe that we cannot achieve something, then we won't. But if we believe that anything is possible, then it is. For spirit, when it comes to answering life's big questions, many of us look to the outside world for the answers. I want you to consider the most important answer lies within you. When you can connect with self, trust your intuition, feel the connection within, the impossible suddenly becomes possible. So by exploring your intuitive self, the spiritual dimension, we can access a deeper level of understanding and wisdom. We also talked last week, last month, about masculine and feminine energy. You can recall that now. What it's talking about, it's not about man and woman or male and female. It's about understanding and working with the energy, masculine energy and feminine energy. No matter what sex you are. So with the masculine energy, we have three areas here we're going to discuss briefly: the warrior, the lover, and the provider. So what's the warrior archetype? How does one become the warrior? Before he can be crowned king, he has to have proven himself as a warrior. a warrior fights, not necessarily with his hands, but he has a clear idea of his boundaries. He stands up for self, he protects others, and he follows through on what he's promised. He has a definite power about him. So it's like, don't mess with me. So if the man in your relationship has never had the opportunity to show his warrior, then he's likely to still have that boy energy, too soft. So he needs to develop a warrior archetype. How? Through activities, maybe martial arts or sports on the battlefield. Perhaps that's exactly where he needs to be on the battlefield to develop his warrior type. The lover, he's very much being the Casanova. If he's being what he needs to be for you, he's the Casanova, he's the romantic. And getting that excitement going in the bedroom, more on that coming up. He's a provider. He's able to go out, bring home the bacon, be good with finances. He can be trusted to hold down a job. This is really important. That certainty you need to be there. With a feminine archetype, the peacemaker, she's able to maintain a balance in her home, be intuitive, a good networker, knowing what it takes to make other people happy in the home. The feminine energy, the lover, she's femme fatale. She's a seductress. She's sensual. She's a sex goddess. Develop this in the feminine archetype. Maybe you can start by reading 50 Shades of Grey or something along those lines. The nurturer then, the parent, the caregiver, the mother. Be that healer and guide children and family. You can also recall last month we shared insights on our personal needs. So for a woman to feel loved, she must be understood. So your man needs to tell you, I really want to understand you, or wow, I get that, or whatever the language is between you. For men to be loved, they must be appreciated. So ladies, what your man really needs to hear is, I really appreciate you doing that. Thank you. I really appreciate that. So the lover archetypes govern all types of relationships. All types of relationships. Friendships to spiritual. But the most familiar is the romantic lover. And there's only one person you want to be looking at, and that's your lover. Just something you might find interesting here. If your partner is doing well in business, he's successful in bringing home the money, there's not a lot happening in your sex life, not a lot of sexual energy going on, don't assume that he's not having sex. This is important. If there is still a lot of charismatic energy coming from your partner, if there is...
Okay, I found this...
Oh, go away, Siri. If he's still got a lot of charismatic energy coming from your partner, then keeping themselves very attractive and he's very sensual and you're not having sexual relations with him, then you can see a change in him. You want to take more care. Understand that they may be getting themselves ready for attraction elsewhere. So if that energy is not happening with you, this is a big warning sign. Listen to what the universe is telling you. Listen to what your partner is saying, even if you're not verbally, because once that partner has moved down the track of significantly, there is not much hope of return. That works with both of you. There are three components that make a very passionate and fulfilling relationship. So the first is romance. And this is the job of the alpha male. Romance is his job. The moment she has to do it all the romancing, it's the beginning of the end. I'm not saying you can't romance him at times, but, you know, instinctually, it's the male's job. He needs to chase her. He needs to woo her. It's not the job of the female. He must be the knight in shining armor, the white knight. He needs to do romantic dinners, book weekends away, random flowers, leaving notes around, and making it beautiful. Intimacy, holding hands, kissing passionately, making out, trail her body with kisses, and sucking the parts she adores most. It's really important that this is done affectionately, much of it in front of the kids or friends. It makes her feel the significant other. It makes the children feel certain. It makes them feel loved. It makes them feel a part of a loving environment. And when all these things are happening at the highest level, then comes sexual energy. Intercourse. Make it really exciting. Lots of variety. Educate each other in this area. What do you want and what do you want to do for the other? If you have a very boring sex life, then you need to brush up on your language. Look at those the five love languages that we talked about before. So what you want from her is more education in this area, and also what he wants is more education. And we can all do that. You want to be able to download the sex goddess, the seductress, and even the whore. Many men like a whore in the bedroom. If that works for you, great. If not, tell him. But bring it on. Whatever works for both of you. And have lots of fun doing it. Be adventurous. In order for this to happen, there needs to be incredible trust between the couple. There is more adventure happening when she can really trust her partner. When you're communicating, when the relationship is going well, this is really pumping. When the relationship is not doing well, this is the first place to stop. The best friends archetype, have fun, play together. What can you do together that is fun and playful and creative? And when you're doing that, you have more things to talk about, apart from kids. The parent archetype, it's the caregiver, the provider, raising children, having pets or a business. The purpose of this is to take care of something outside of self, to give birth to something, to create a forest, to create a garden, a magic garden. So for lovers, it's parental love, protection and nurturing. The protector, he needs to be the king, the father, the leader, the power, the warrior, the judge, the policeman, the guardian, the protector. The nurturer, she needs to be the queen, the mother, the healer, the teacher, the guide, the mentor, the peacemaker, the creator. Altogether, this is where you have true love together. And when there are children, they feel safe and loved, and that's really important. So looking at the components of all of this, is this happening in your life or not? Remember, the most important relationship is a relationship between the couple or the marriage, not the children. I'm going to repeat that. The most important relationship is the relationship or the marriage. It's between the couple, not the children. The children grow up and they're going to go away. The relationship, you want to keep on track with love and devotion, and that allows the children to feel safe. So let's delve into now a little bit of the clearing shadows and blind spots. So before we start clearing shadows and blind spots, you must first bring into your awareness your beliefs and explore their creation. Where did they come from? Beliefs, the quality of your life is in direct proportion to the amount of uncertainty or variety you can live with and play with. We do emotions that we are most rewarded for. We're not addicted to drugs. We're addicted to the problems. So we can say, I'm not responsible. It's a problem. The very first question, most important question here, is, are you living above the line or living below the line? Do you take responsibility or do you shift responsibility for what's happening in your life? Are you blaming or accusing others for what's going on in your world? Or are you justifying or making excuses for why you cannot do, cannot be, and cannot have what you want? Great questions, huh? Defining moments. Defining moments are, these are things, events, situations that happen to us. Everyone has experienced defining moments in their lives. Moments that shape who we are and the choices we make. These moments can be fabulous, moments that we want to treasure and may have been a great source of joy throughout our life. Alternatively, these moments can be painful moments that we have tried very hard to forget, escape from, or to minimize. We develop beliefs to support our initial interpretation of the event, and then build a lifetime searching for evidence to confirm that belief. Our reality is made up of what we believe. I'm going to repeat that. Our reality is made up of what we believe, what we perceive, what we experience during life, what we see, what we hear, and what we feel. Our minds will hunt out proof of whatever it is we want to believe. A great place to start answering these questions is by looking at your beliefs and the defining moments in your life. It's not the defining moments that matter. It's not what happened to you. It's your interpretation of the situation that shape your future and who you are today. It's what you tell yourself in that defining moment. You create an interpretation of the event or the situation based on your experience and your beliefs. I want to tell you a story by way of illustration so you can gain some crystal clear understanding of what this means. I had a client who identified as a child a defining moment in her life. Trying to keep this simple so you can understand. A time when her parents locked her up in her room for the night and would not rescue her when she cried. Now, regardless of whatever judgment may come for you or what belief you give this moment, it is different for all of us. On that evening, with her parents locking her away in her room, this was a defining moment for her because in that moment, she told herself, I am alone. I'm not lovable. Now, there's no question. She could have told herself something different. She could have told herself, oh, I'll go to sleep then. It's okay. Or they'll be back. Or I forgive them. What happened is irrelevant. What matters is what she has been telling herself all her life since that event happened, now in her 50s. As a result of that event, the defining moment, she chose the belief, I will be alone. I will always be alone. I'm not worthy of love. As a consequence of that belief, she unconsciously sought out evidence or proof to confirm that this belief throughout her lifetime. She attached herself to unavailable men, had few friends, and worked in isolation. Because her belief was, people will let me down. It's not the defining moment that matters. That moment is past. It is our interpretation of that situation, of the defining moment, that shapes our future and who we are today. We tell ourselves something about what that defining moment means. We give ourselves an interpretation of the event based on our experience of beliefs. The power of your beliefs is phenomenal. Our minds seek out evidence of whatever seed we plant within it. Most of us have had 5 to 8 or more defining moments in our life. When we are young, we don't have the awareness to tell ourselves this person makes poor choices and it's not about me. I won't allow their choice to affect me. When we are young and our parents or siblings or partners or friends do something that hurts, all we know is that hurts. The people who are central to our lives as children and young adults have a huge influence on what we believe about ourselves and what we will communicate to ourselves and ultimately our children if we don't become aware of it and create change around it. So the first key to creating change or transformation is to have self-awareness, which is what we're doing right now. I'm just going to check this message. Okay. The second key is to know that how we defined ourselves as children is not how we have to define ourselves as adults. You are free to choose what you believe. With self-awareness comes tremendous empowerment. Our parents made mistakes. Yes, Jesus, they're human. And now you have a choice about how long you will pay for their mistakes. I want to talk about three universal fears. Let's focus some time on that and understanding fear and where it's come from. One of the first things I want to ask you is, at cause or above the line, if you're there, all of the love-based emotions are at cause. So coming from love is joy, happiness, enthusiasm, passion, excitement, a sense of adventure. All of these examples are expressions of love. Abundance is also an expression of love. Scarcity, on the other hand, the flip to abundance, is fear and scarcity. And it's below the line at effect. So yes, scarcity is actually a form of fear. When we have what's known as scarcity mentality around our health or around our energy or around a core relationship or scarcity around money or any of these things, it's a fear-based expression. Now, at the weekend retreat, you have the opportunity to do some deep sea diving around this. At the retreat, you have the opportunity to do experience living at cause and not at effect. There are two primordial emotions in life. Primordial, it just means from the beginning of time. So from the beginning of time, these emotions have always been there. Love and fear. You need to understand that every expression of emotion is either an expression of fear, a cry for help, or is an expression of love? The first universal fear is I'm just not good enough. This is really interesting. When someone does anger or someone expresses frustration, it's a form of fear being expressed. And unconsciously, what that person is saying is, I'm screaming out for your help. I just don't know how to ask for it. So when someone is being angry with you or annoyed with you, or even if you're experiencing these emotions yourself, it's a cry for help of some kind. And it's fear-based. And it's all below the line at affect. At the end of the day, every human being, regardless of how uniquely they express their fears, we are all actually afraid of the same things. And when we realize that we're not alone, these universal fears are experienced by all, then all of a sudden, we don't feel as alone anymore. We don't feel like we're a freak, or we don't feel like there's something wrong with us. And the really cool thing is we can create a shift around this stuff in a heartbeat. So there are three universal fears, and these are fears that we all have at some level. So to clarify, the fear about not being good enough or being found out. The fear is not being good enough or being found out. And we all have this on some level, as I just said. And I don't know about you, but when I first discovered that this was a universal fear, a fear that everyone has an experience of, I really felt such a huge release and relief, because suddenly I actually felt that I could still experience that fear and not being good enough and be totally functional. Because I knew that everybody has some experience, some aspect of that fear. So the fear of not being good enough and fear of being found out are fears that a lot of people like to hide in secret. Let's go with an example for illustration. I've worked with real estate agents now in some way, shape, or form for over 20 years. I actually spent many years in the industry myself to learn from the inside. So you can imagine in those 20 years, I worked as a trainer in licensing and delivered ongoing professional training. And I worked alongside them as competitors for some of them. And in the most recent years, I've coached real estate principals and their staff in performance development. So I've kind of got a good idea about the people in the industry as a whole. One of the people that comes to mind is a young man called Chris Gilmore. I met him in 2010 for the first time. He was young, early 30s, and been working in real estate for 10 years. And this young agent has been and still is very successful and quite an expert at his craft. And one day at a conference, he came over to me and said to me, "Evelyn, I'm amazed how nervous I still get, how scared I get on Saturday mornings when I have to deliver an auction." And remember, he had been doing this now for at least a decade. So what he said to me was this: "Evelyn, it's really funny, but I still get really scared, really nervous when I'm preparing for my auction every time." So I asked him this question: "How long have you had this fear of being found out?" Well, he looked at me like I had two heads, like I was this magical creature that could read minds, a mystical mind reader. The expression on his face was gold, and he said, "Who are you to know that? That's been a secret I've been holding on to now for such a long time." He was clearly blown away by my comment. And it's because this universal fear that he was tapping into is a fear of not being good enough. And someone might find that out today at this auction. You know, that was his fear. And can I say, there's nothing magical about it. And yes, to a degree, we can all read minds if we understand how to read body language. Because when you know this stuff, when you understand there are three universal fears, it all makes so much sense. And we now know that everyone has an aspect of that. So if someone is actually experiencing this fear, this incredible nervousness, and each time they're going to do this thing, whatever it might be, this with this gavel and the buyers and the vendors, he felt that this just might be the day that he was going to be found out, or finally someone would call him on his fear of not being good enough. Now, I've said it before, we all have this in varying capacities. I certainly know that when I started my coaching business, you know, I had this going on big time. And the way I managed it was I just kept showing up. I kept doing the actions. I kept doing the things I needed to do. Everything I needed to do, I kept doing it. Yeah, when you think about all you must do, you can sometimes feel fear, overwhelm. But what I have found is the antidote to all these fears, the antidote to any expression of fear is action. And if this is the only thing you take away from this session, it's been worth it just for that. The antidote to all your fear is action. Remember that. And when a lot of people start to invest a lot of time in their fears, what happens is it magnifies and it grows. And that's because there is inaction. So when you go out and do the thing, whatever the thing is for you, when you go out and do the thing, the fear will disappear. It goes away. So the universal fear number two is not belonging. We are all unconsciously driven to belong to something, to belong to a tribe, to belong to a team, to belong to a family, to belong to a cause, to belong to something. We all have this. And it's an unconscious driver. You know the cliche, no man is an island? Forgive me for the patriarchal expression, but no man is an island. It's a cliche, and it's so true. No one can be alone. We all need to belong to something, whether it's physically to our family, physically in a tribe, whether it's physically to a cause. We need to belong to something. That's why we love joining up with like-minded people. You know, one of the comments I often hear in my trainings and coaching is that it's been a fantastic time spending 2, 3, or 4 days with people who are like-minded. What that person is really saying to me is that the fear of not belonging has been managed. It's been met. In other words, they're not suffering or experiencing the fear of not belonging because they feel they are belonging in that environment. And one of the best ways to self-manage, one of the most important ways to maintain your sense of awareness and personal power, has to be through your managing and belonging to a cause or belonging to something. For example, for most of my training and coaching career in my business, I work from home. And of course, my husband is retired now. I have always worked mainly from home. My children were either at school or uni, and now they're both married and got their own families and cruising along very nicely. And it's so awesome to see. So that means I spend a lot of time at home alone, me and my Mac. Yes, I speak with people. I make calls. I coach people on the phone, or I coach people face-to-face. I hire venues and run public training sessions, and I run workshops too. But primarily, I spend a lot of time on my own. So even though I connect with people, I got to a point where I had stopped training myself, paused by my own personal development for a few years. And I remember there was this fear of not belonging. I was noticing it. It's like I didn't feel like I belonged to anything specifically. So being a lone wolf is great, but it's also hard. Outside my family, of course, who I always feel like I belonged, I didn't seem to belong. And even way back when I was a school kid, I mean, in my early days, I sometimes felt at that time, way back then, that I didn't belong in any particular tribe. And I remember a couple of things I did, which was started to subscribe to various online forums and groups, and I joined the gym. And there was a particular activity that I like, and that is meeting regularly, and it's such a supportive environment. It's pretty much the same with people. And the fear of not belonging was managed by my going out to the gym or joining some meetings a few times a week. And I always use a calendar now, so it's stamped into my diary, it's stamped into my brain, ongoing. So I had something to belong to. You can see now that all of us have this, and that can be expressed, of course, through a sense of belonging to family. But sometimes belonging to one tribe might not be enough. You might need to belong to a number of tribes. So fear of not belonging is the second universal fear. The third universal fear is not being loved. And this is something that goes way back from our first 0 to 7 years of life. I've spoken briefly about the imprint period, the modeling period, and the socialization period. You can remember that now. 0 to 7 years, 7 to 15, and 15 to 23 years. You can recall these periods of time now. You see, way back in the first 0 to 7 years of life, especially before the age of 6, where there is no critical factor, there's no ego, these universal fears don't exist. We didn't actually have the fear of not being loved, the fear of not belonging, or the fear of not being enough. They weren't there. These specific fears were not there because we automatically belong. The fact that we breathe means that we belong. And I spoke about an extreme example during the war when Hitler tried to create the perfect blonde hair, blue-eyed, cold-as-ice individuals. He did that by stealing babies and locking them away for his research. Those babies were not held, not loved in the first 2 years, and mostly they did not survive because these universal fears take over. And essentially, they kill the child who's not experiencing any love. So if I can speak from the base of it and make a sweeping generalization, that is all of us were loved. And clearly, if you're listening to this program and you're over the age of 7, you've been loved at some point and you belonged to something, to some group, to some tribe, to your mother, to those who cared for you, as a parent should, or to your family, regardless of what family that is, your extended family, whatever that means for you, you were loved by somebody somewhere. But what happens is, when the critical factor kicks in, when the ego comes to the forefront at the age of around 7, we start moving into that survival knowing. It's where the ego begins. It's where it's present. The ego is there to protect us and to keep us safe. From there, all the values and beliefs get formulated. And our map of the world in our head, our model of the world, begins to be constructed. And over the ensuing next 15 to 20 plus years, after that, we become a hunter and gatherer of evidence to construct our map and our model of the world. While all of this is happening unconsciously, that's where the three universal fears start to kick in. What we are deeply longing for, really, is to go back to those unconditional moments, those unconditional years where we were loved beyond any judgment, where we belonged without any doubt, where we were enough, no matter what the circumstances may have been. And that's really what we're longing for unconsciously, all of us. So I trust that this conversation around the three universal fears is going to be valuable to you, and that it has also enabled you to realize that those secrets that you've been holding on to, perhaps, maybe within yourself, around something being wrong with you, or you've had this fear of being found out for some time, and you thought maybe it was just you, or if you had a fear unconsciously or of not belonging to something, that you don't fit into anything anywhere, or if you have experienced any thoughts or feelings around not being loved, just know that you're not alone. There are over 6 billion other human beings that are feeling the same thing. In common society, these are secrets that people don't wish to express because they fear that if they express them to someone who doesn't understand these fears, they will be judged as being a bit of off-center or being a bit nuts or there's something wrong with them. In other words, by expressing the fears, what gets reinstated are the fear of something that is wrong with me. So now that you know that these fears are universal, that everyone has them at some point, your parents, your friends, your mentors, it doesn't matter who it is that you look up to in life. All of us have various aspects of this. So what it comes down to is how well we manage it. When you can combine all the knowledge around this, then you're equipped, you're armed immediately, instantaneously with the skill set in a heartbeat to manage your fears. So remember, the antidote to fear is action. By going out and doing something, you will actually become something else. Repeat that. By going out and doing something, by taking action, you will actually become something else. If you don't do anything, you won't become. So I trust this is a conversation around the three universal fears has been not only interesting for you, but also very useful for you. Something that you can pass on, take away with you, and immediately pass on to those who are close to you in your life, the ones that you love, and who are perhaps open to a conversation with you around this. So I'm going to dip a little bit deeper now into the imprint period. It's curious, isn't it, that how we as human beings form our life's values from such a young age, even as young as 0 to 7 years. How do we decide or conclude our values? What is it that has us decide what's more important in life, important to you or me, versus what's important to our siblings, parents, close friends, partners? The imprint period is where everything is accepted unconditionally. And within that period of 0 to 7, the first 2 years is all about certainty, the need of love. And need of certainty and love in those first years is very important. As we move into the ages of 3 to 4, it becomes clearly about power and creating power and knowing what boundaries can be crossed and what boundaries can't be crossed. Regardless of what your adult perceptions are or what they tell you, I want you to do something for me right now, something fun. Put on your cap of a 3 or 4 year old. As we continue here, I want you to stay open, judgment free. Whatever comes your way, don't judge it. Be open to it. Let's try that on right now. Put your 3 or 4 year old cap on. Let's try that right now. I have my 3 year old cap on when I tell you this story. One of the reasons why Michael Jackson, love him or hate him, the reason why he loved being with kids, why he was drawn so much to children under the age of 7, was because these were the only human beings left on the planet that had no opinion of him, didn't know who he was, and had no judgment on him. And if you, just for a nanosecond, can put yourself in his shoes. Not an easy thing to do, but try it on. Imagine what it would have been like to be him. Where you are known almost by the population of the entire planet, in the Western society at least. And wherever you go, you've got screaming fans. I mean, if the only people in this world you can be with is a 3 or 4 year old who doesn't have an opinion on you, who doesn't care for what you are, who you are, doesn't have a judgment, doesn't want you for any other reason than to just be, you can appreciate why he would be attracted to being with children at that age. I think it's really sad how all that happened in the end, of course, but that's a whole other story. We're not going to go there right now. So moving on to the age of 5 to 7, from the age of 5 to 7 and a little bit beyond, it becomes about self-worth and our worthiness now, and a sense of self-esteem begins to develop based on our experiences and the meaning we put on our life, on our experiences of life at that age. As we approach 6, even 7, we start moving to the age of the truth, where we are ready to hear that Santa doesn't exist. We want to hear that. We want to know the truth. We don't want to be lied to about our environment. We are ready to learn about how the world works, how we were created. We're ready to hear about sex. We're ready to hear about most everything there is. So in other words, at the age of 7, you don't want to continue with myths and untruths. You want people to start talking straight, because a 7-year-old is ready for straight talk. By now, the ego has placed itself in parts of our lives that is has no business being in. On the other hand, it's where it continues to hold us safe and protect us from things that are really holding us back. In other words, the ego these days is holding people back from embracing the unfamiliar and expanding our comfort zone and growing as a result, because it wants us to stay safe. And staying safe is sameness. And that's not healthy. So the modeling stage we spoke about, between 8 and 15 years, this is where we start modeling people in our environment. The rock stars, the movie, the actors, all the people that are in their world on the TV. We also spoke about modeling the imprint period. We spoke about modeling the modeling period. We moved on to the socialization period, which is around 15 to 23 years. This is where we become the hunter and the gatherer, excuse me, of evidence to support the conclusions that we've made about life. So in summary, the first 2 years of our life is driven by our need for certainty and our need for love. When you think about it, certainty is another way of saying needy, and it's also about love. We are absolutely 100% reliant upon our environment and relying upon the person who cares for us, our mother or father or our guardian. You know, we are totally reliant. Everything needs to be done for us. There's that word again, needy. Everything, all our needs, there is no choice. We need to have our nappy changed. We need to be fed. We need to be put down to sleep. We need to be dressed. We need to be held and cuddled. So the first 2 years are all about need, certainty, and love, all of it. Moving on to beyond 2, the age of 2 or 3, the theme changes. It becomes more about power. For those of you who are parents and listening to this, you'll notice something. Those who have parenting experience, you'll be listening to this and knowing with smiles on your face, because heading into the 3s and 4s, the child starts to test their boundaries. I have 2 children myself. My son is now 38 and he's got his own 2 toddlers. And my daughter is now 33 and now has a 1.5-year-old baby. They are certainly totally different, all of them. And I remember, especially my daughter at around 2 to 3 years, And three and four. I remember really vividly that she was always testing boundaries. Oh my goodness, testing the limits. She was really curious. And I mean, really, really curious about the boundaries. I'm not sure if you can relate to this, and you can, because I'm sure that you can. You all have children. She really pushed it to see how far she could get. She quickly found out she could get far further with her father than with her mother. And this practice for children goes a long way in formulating their values. Those boundaries that we set for our children at that early age goes a long way for them to formulate their own values and beliefs about moving forward in life. So we have a huge influence on them. So you'll notice I said formulate their values. And the reason is each child may be brought up in the same household, same parents, same rules, even if there are twins. Everything is exactly the same in regard to their environment and where the lines are drawn. The rules about what they can get away with might be identical, but the human mind is really quite amazing because each child will still formulate their own thoughts, their own beliefs, and usually different values around them and their upbringing. So the key thing that you need to learn here is, even though I'm giving you the structure of how it is with human psyche and how the human psyche creates beliefs and how we become the way we are, know that all of us can be exposed to identical environments and yet turn out totally different. I can remember a story about twin boys that grew up in a household with an abusive father. Those twins at 30 were interviewed separately. They both lived different lives, lived in different parts of the country even, and grew up to be pole opposites of each other. You may have heard similar stories. A story like that is exactly what I'm talking about here. Environments are identical, but they turned out totally different. Their values and beliefs differ immensely, and they grew up to be individuals with totally different outlooks on life. So from the age of 2 to 3, and even 4, it's all about power. It's about testing power, and it's about seeing what it is they can get away with or not. So briefly moving forward towards kids of 4 and 5, a child adopts a new theme at this age, and that theme is worthiness, self-worth. What happens to us at around 5 really does have an impact on our self-worth. I'm going to make it really easy for you to understand. How do the actions or non-actions of others impact us at the age of 5? It's by reward or punishment. In other words, we often reward our children. I'm not talking about literal rewards such as lollies and cake, etc. What I mean by reward is who we are. Taking it deeper, by reward, I mean giving your child a loving smile just because they entered the room. That's reward. That's giving them love versus ignoring the child when they walk into the room. Because ignoring the child is an act or a form of punishment. Not to be confused by punishment by hitting, which some people still might do. I'm talking about something as simple as ignoring your child. And there are many ways that we can withdraw our love, only one of which is to ignore them. The point I'm making here is at the age of 5, we can experience love with a simple smile. Or we can feel the withdrawal of love by being ignored. And that goes a long way towards the level of self-worth felt by a child. So what we're really saying here is at the age of 5, our self-esteem is being developed. Going beyond that age, onto 6 and 7 years, our esteem continues to develop. the age of 5 to 7 is a really sensitive time, and it's a time when self-esteem is being developed, and it's when we are starting to formulate opinions about ourselves. Our sense of self-worth is forming for life at this young age. Moving on to the 7-year-olds, this is pivotal. It's a time in life, it's really important because at the age of 7, we start to approach the time of truth. At the age of 7, we're ready to hear that Santa doesn't exist. At the age of 7, we're ready to hear that the Easter Bunny is an urban myth. Now, we are ready to hear that it's not a tooth fairy that places the coin under our pillow when we lose our tooth. At the age of 7, we're ready for the truth. Having said that, just because we are ready for the truth doesn't mean it doesn't hurt us. It can hit us hard when we do find that Santa and the Easter Bunny don't really exist. I remember it vividly when I told my son that Santa doesn't really exist and that Santa is a beautiful fantasy we share with children. Even though I tried very hard to let him down easily, his response was, "Mum, does that mean that the Easter Bunny isn't true either?" His words. "And the Tooth Fairy?" I explained, "Yeah, that's right." And after my lengthy explanation about the beauty and importance of fantasy for children, he turned to me and he asked, "Mum, that means you lied to me. You and Dad lied to me all this time," and he began to cry. Wow. Now, being a parent, you get how this is heartbreaking. It was for me. As a mum, and what made it even more difficult was I had to explain the lying, as he put it, is not really lying when it comes to Santa. And I explained in it in as much detail as I thought a kid could understand why it's not lying. Excuse me. Because he reminded me that I've told him over and over, again and again, he should never lie to me. So that was tough. So revealing the truth to someone about Santa and the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy was heart-wrenching for everyone. And it was really an intense experience for him. He felt betrayed. He even got angry with me for lying. He was crying tears of hurt and anger that we had been lying to him all this time. So although he was ready to hear the truth, it can still hurt. Also, at the age of 7, we're entering the world of survival. We are born to survive. A 7-year-old in the extreme, a child at 7 can survive without their parents. 7 is a very pivotal age. Although at the age of 7, it is critical. The critical faculties kick in, which is the ego. And as we go from the imprint period to the modelling period and into the socialisation period, the age of 7 to 15 and beyond, we start to notice that there is an ego that starts to be present, which is also known as a critical faculty. Ego, if we talk about that for a moment, what is this thing called ego? What does it mean? And what doesn't it mean? In our early teenage years, the child is moving into the stage of survival where they can fend for themselves within reason. It's through ego that we learn the rules of survival. What I mean by that, the rules of survival, is we learn about the fundamental laws, like the law of gravity, and we only need to burn our finger once in a naked flame or over a hot iron to know we don't do it again unless we want to get burnt. So in other words, that ego is purely a mechanism that's designed to keep us alive, keep us safe. Way back in the day of the Neanderthal, we were living a much simpler life. Life was about just finding the next feed and protecting the nest. In those days, we would run from the saber-toothed tiger or be eaten. That's fight or flight. So back in those days, ego was extremely useful. It's equally extremely useful today, but there are different... It's different in... we have different kind of distinctions. Back then, the ego needs were totally fulfilled because its purpose was complete. It was there to alert us of danger, and it kicks in the flight or fight mode, which is the biological reaction to danger. When this happens, there is a certain chemical that kicks into our system so we can sprint or run away as fast as possible in order to survive, to be alive, to stay alive, to be protected, to remain safe. That's a predominant feature and benefit and purpose of the existence of the ego, and it starts at around 7. It's curious because these days the ego is often misunderstood. Why? Because these days ego is much more than running away from a saber-toothed tiger. In psychology, there is something called ego state therapy, and it refers to the ego as those little voices that exist within us. Let's keep it simple and call it your mini-me. So this mini-me, the voices inside your head, they say things like, you'll be found out, or you can't do that, or you're not good enough, or who's going to love you, or who do you think you are? So these voices exist within us. And in the ego state therapy, they actually say that in a fully functioning individual, there are up to about 15 different personalities that exist within all of us. In other words, 15 different voices. So now you know you're not going crazy. There are voices in our heads all the time. It's good to know, right? Anyhow, these different voices within us, they form different archetypes of different images, of different purposes. The predominant purpose unites all of these voices is survival. In actual fact, fight or flight responses is still used a lot in the Western society, at least. But what we're actually doing is when we're running away from psychological constructs. In other words, we are threatened by fears of a different kind, not based on any evidence or fact or truth. Let me give you an example. I have a cousin, Liz. She lives on the Northern Beaches. And Liz tells me that every time she has to cross the Sydney Harbour Bridge, she goes into a panic attack every time, every time. So she stopped driving across the bridge. She can take a bus, so it's okay, but she can't drive across the bridge. So she's too scared in case she has an accident. She's too frightened. So she has a panic attack every time she crosses a bridge in a car. Now, it's not because of any real threat. It's not because of any real fictitious animal. And in saying that, we must respect and understand that people who have panic attacks have a real fear. That's why they're calling it panic attack. But it is a psychological construct. It is something that is in their head, something they have designed and created unconsciously based on their past experience in life. In fact, anything that's based on fear comes from our ego, because the ego doesn't like change. The ego doesn't like progress. The ego doesn't like growth. The ego is anti-growth. It wants everything to stay the same. An ego is heavily linked in most people to their identity. How we see ourselves is linked to our ego. And any time our identity is threatened, what I mean by threatened is, I'm not talking about life or death situation. What I'm talking about is how we've always seen the world, or we've discovered a whole range of new belief systems, or we've discovered a whole new way of thinking, or a whole new way to be, a whole new way to live, or a whole new way to access our own power. That's our identity being threatened. I hope that makes sense. Often, there is a reaction to that. And what that means is, when there is a reaction, it's like a hot button is being pushed. That's your ego. Excuse me. It's your ego saying, stop. I don't need to know this, because we've been doing fine until now. For what purpose would I need to learn this new, unfamiliar stuff when we're doing okay? Thank you very much. The easiest way to be clear when your ego is in control versus when it's not in control is anytime you are reacting to something in life, reacting in fear, reacting in frustration, any of these emotions are negative. So frustration, anger, depression, formulating in acts of procrastination or self-sabotage. All of these kind of things, they're all linked to the ego. To know that it's not coming from ego is when you're coming from a place of compassion, empathy, love, joy, peace, satisfaction. All of these heartfelt feelings and heartfelt experiences come from a place of love. And that place of love is non-ego. Anything that is anti-love or non-love, fear-based, is ego. And that's the fastest and easiest way that I know for you to recognize your ego is speaking. We'll talk more about that as we go through the retreat. But to survive, the ego needs to be born. And that happens when we're about around 7. We make the same mistakes, because if we continue making the same mistakes, it means that we're not progressing. We're not changing. We're not embracing the unknown. And by doing that, we get to stay in a comfort zone. And of course, if you stay in your comfort zone, you can't grow. You can't expand. It continues to shrink to a point where you reach what's known as a crisis point, a life crisis, or what's commonly known as the midlife crisis. What does a midlife crisis mean to you? Let's look at it. What could it be? It could be if someone has not learned to sustainably and continually expand their comfort zone. It's someone who is investing a lot of energy, time, and money in remaining in their comfort zone. At one point, you are going to experience a crisis, because your comfort zone is going to be so tight, so small, so minuscule, that you're going to feel really uncomfortable. And for the first time in a long time, you'll be experiencing pain, where formerly there was no pain. So it's fascinating, isn't it? So the modeling period from 8 to 15 years, this is where we begin to model the popular girl at school. We learn to grow in knowledge. We see others and decide if we want to be like them or not. We start modeling our environment. It's where we begin to learn how to survive in the world. Yes, we get to model the most popular person in school and the other stuff, but we are also modeling different people in our world to learn how to be and how to learn how to fit in. So we're modeling how to speak, how not to speak. We're modeling how to treat people. We're modeling how it is that we are who we are. How to walk down the street. How to take up a sport. What's fascinating about this is where we're doing this naturally, especially between the ages of 8 to 15, we forget to do this as adults. And one of the huge lessons in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, teaches us is that if you are noticing something is getting the results that you want, and look, it doesn't matter what phase of life we're talking about here, whether we're talking at the age of 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, whatever it might be. If you're noticing that someone in your sphere of influence or in your realm of expertise who is experiencing the results that you and you are not, you can utilize modeling to actually model the way they think, model the way they focus, model what they focus on, model aspects of their energy, perhaps even model how they even walk at times to get the results that you want to achieve, to get the results that you want to achieve. That we do through modeling. All right, we're getting toward the end now. It's a little bit over time, guys. I hope you're okay with that. So I'm going to skip through some of this other stuff that I've got here now, since we're running out of time. Well, this one's important. So from the age of 15 to 23 and beyond, we're moving into the phase known as socialization. This is effectively where we become the hunter and gatherer of evidence to support our opinions, our beliefs, and our conclusions that we've come to about life at this stage. In other words, let's say for some reason we have formulated a belief around love. Maybe it's that we might have come up with a belief that we are lovable. As a result of that, we become a hunter and gatherer of evidence to support the conclusion that we are lovable. On the flip side, you might have another person who has come to the conclusion through the experiences of life that at the age of 21, that we are unlovable. And that person's come up with the belief that they are not lovable. They become a hunter and gatherer of evidence in their adult life to support the proof, the evidence they are not lovable. I'm going to give you some more on the science of human behavior in terms of how that actually happens. But before I do, I want to share how important it is. What I have just shared with you is this. We become a hunter and gatherer of proof. Proof that what we believe, what we have created as our belief, is true. We go searching for that validation that we are unlovable or that we are lovable. And we come to the sweeping conclusion that's just how life is. For example, I mentioned before I worked with real estate agents for over 20 years. I've trained a lot of agents and I've also consulted to them in their business. So I've got a pretty good idea of how the industry works. And a lot of the time I get asked the question, Evelyn, tell me how many people have done this course and started working in the industry and have not succeeded, bailed out or shut their doors? Or how many people have done this course and succeeded? Well, the stats on that is this. It was reported by the Australian Financial Review in 2011 that during 2010, we had 10,000 agents leave the industry. here in Australia. And that's happening again now over the last 2 to 3 years, the same thing. That's about 1 in 6 have abandoned their profession. But official stats to the side. Please put the stats to the side. The answer is, no matter what industry, no matter what profession you are in, the answer is the same. And here it is. If you want evidence of people who have done well, who have succeeded, then you're going to find it. If you're looking for evidence of people who have not succeeded, have not done well, then you're going to find it. So I mentioned earlier that in July 2012, I convened some real estate conferences and shared the stage with many, many amazing people. Those people at that time were in the worst, which what was, according to Financial Review, the worst time in real estate for decades. Yet the people I know at that conference were excelling. They made more money than they've made in the past 10 years. In the reportedly worst time in the industry. John McGrath, at that time in 2012, he announced at the conference that he has his first office in Queensland. He now has more than 36 offices. So as I said earlier, whatever evidence you are looking for, you will find. I guarantee it, 100%. So all the evidence we need for anything is present in our environment. What it comes down to is what you do, what you want to focus on. Do you want to focus on the evidence that supports your conclusion about something, or do you want evidence for that doesn't support the conclusion that you have about something? All right. Some people say life sucks and then you die. Well, if that's what you want to live your life like, then that's a perfect way of thinking. However, if you prefer to believe that you are totally capable, absolutely lovable, and are a huge success, then that is what you will create. I want you to hang in here because this part now is important for you to understand. Our beliefs, what we perceive, is what we project. So perception is projection. Our beliefs govern how we perceive the world. Our beliefs are feelings of certainty about what something means. Our beliefs create our world. Every belief is made up. If beliefs are not reality, why not make up beliefs that will support us, nurture us, and create ideal lives? Beliefs are based on past experiences, 0 to 7, 7 to 15, and 15 to 23 and beyond. Beliefs are based on our past experience in life, in this life. Those beliefs can either take us forward or hold us back. They are judgments about competencies, worthiness, acceptability, strengths, weaknesses. The meaning we give our lives and the world around us is directly linked to the beliefs that we have held onto. Even when the beliefs that do not support us, we still do it. We behave in a certain way as a result of our beliefs, and based on this, we send out messages to the world. So we spoke about the Enneagram over the last month or so. I just want to reflect for a moment on the earlier webinars. And you can remember we went through a rather extensive overview of the Enneagram, and most of you have done your Enneagram survey, which is fantastic, because that way you're beginning to understand the people's psychology. You were recently introduced to the DISC profiling and relationship questionnaire. All of these amazing resources are leading you to enlightenment of who you are and why you do what you do. More specifically, human behavior is key to understand and embracing the path of knowledge with open arms. It will allow you to dig deeper into now and on towards your future. So NLP is how we're going to connect during our coaching sessions. We have been connecting using NLP, and we will continue to do so. We want to use the language of the mind to consistently achieve our specific and desired outcomes. NLP is modeling excellence to improve your results. So neuro-linguistic programming. Neuro because our experiences, both conscious and unconscious, are derived through and from our senses and our central nervous system. Linguistic is because our mental processes are also coded like a computer. Our brain is like a computer, organizes the beliefs, the meanings, the experiences, and the transformed through language. Programming is because people interact as a system. It means our experience and communication are composed of sequences of patterns or programs. So a simple definition, or a few different simple definitions of NLP, is NLP is a method of modeling success, modeling excellence. It's the language of the mind, so you can consistently achieve your desired outcomes. Whatever the definition makes sense to you is perfect. NLP is modeling excellence. It's having the ability to access the language of your mind to achieve your desired outcomes. It may sound complex, but it's really very simple. And I find it absolutely amazing, fascinating, and the speed of which you can create change in self and in others through the world of NLP. It's really amazing what you can do when you're ready. People hold on to stuff for years, some for a lifetime. And yet with NLP, in most cases, it takes just minutes to help someone release negative emotions and redefine their limiting beliefs. Things they've been holding on to for many years, zapped in an instant. So clearing shadows and blind spots means restructuring the neural pathways using NLP. So it's really, really important that we understand this. The form of coaching that I use is called NLP, and it's a science. Okay, it's based on, it's science based. Excuse me. And it's proven. I want to speak very, very quickly on quantum physics. Quantum physics is a branch of science that deals with discrete, indivisible units of energy called quanta. Stay with me here. You can look it up in Google later on, but here's my take on it. Quantum physics contains many clues as to the fundamental nature of the universe and is more important than even relativity in the grand scheme of things. What it really describes is the nature of the universe as being much different than the world we see. Now, I've got to tell you that, you know, quantum physics is mostly way beyond my comprehension, like way beyond. So let me try and explain it to you how it was explained to me. We live in a super pure potentiality. And living in a super pure potentiality means that in all the empty space around us, in the room you're already sitting in right now, all that empty space, that invisible space around us, everything exists. What do I mean? In this very moment, all of the radio stations are playing. All of the channels on the TV are playing. All of the songs and all of the talkbacks is existing in this room right now. All the thoughts and conversations going around the world is existing in this room right now. All we have to do is plug into it, turn the dial, and plug into it. We're just not plugged in right now because we're tuned into our own physical level of conscious awareness, if that makes some sense. So I often listen to podcasts when I'm driving long distances, and one of the things that stayed with me was a recording by Deepak Chopra. And he was saying that we as human beings are either the choosers of thoughts or the interpreters of thoughts. We don't actually create the thoughts. Interesting. I'll say it again. We are either choosers of thoughts or interpreters of thoughts. We don't actually create the thought. So what he was saying was we're not even the creators of our thoughts. Interesting. What he was saying was, it's actually our soul that is the creator of thoughts. And when I refer to our soul, I refer to the unconscious mind. It's the same thing. The unconscious mind is the creator of thoughts. But we, in our conscious awareness, we choose what thoughts to have, or we are interpreting thoughts. That's all we're doing. In this diagram on the screen right now, this is to show you that the unconscious mind is the big purple part down the bottom and the conscious mind is the top. Dr. Peter Schneider at the Sydney University some years ago, he did a test on how we learn. we used to learn 10%, that was thought. Now that's changed. In our conscious mind, consciously, we only learn 10% of what we need to learn. 4% of what we learn is now in our conscious mind, not 10%, 4%. What that means is what we learn in our unconscious is 96%. What we learn at an unconscious level, we will learn 96%. If you think about it consciously, you're only learning 4%. I'll discuss more about that as we go through the event. So, wrapping up, NLP is what we're going to be working with throughout the next couple of months. NLP is it creates a strong, practical foundation for creating change and your transformation as an individual. There is a higher level which is more abstract and has higher truths in the hierarchy, and NLP, which is archetypal coaching, which I will also introduce to you at the retreat. Archetypal coaching is about understanding and mastering the invisible forces that shape our desires and our behavior. Sorry. It gives us access to pure symbols, symbolic, that speak to us in a multidimensional way, helping us to create wisdom and understanding. Understanding this relationship by its very nature takes us to places and gives us access to wisdom and understanding not available using NLP on its own. So understanding archetypes is the alchemy of life. It helps us lead self and others. So I'll talk more about this slide here when I see you again. I want to leave you with with above and below the line. So above and below the line, how do you choose to respond to things? Are you at cause? Do you maintain your power? Do you control or influence yourself? Or do you give it away to others? Do you allow other people to influence you and control you? Do you take responsibility for your life? Or do you shift responsibility? Really important. I need you to think about this, because this is leading, we're getting into the deep diving now. I want you to start thinking about these things. If you don't understand it right now, you will. Okay, you will. Trust me on that. Do you take responsibility for self, or do you shift responsibility? Are you solutions focused, or are you focusing on blaming other people, making accusations, denying, justifying, making excuses? Where do you sit, above the line or below the line? Are you future focused, or are you past focused? Where should you be? Where do you want to be? Where do you want to be to create the best possible transformation possible? Above the line. Above the line, you're self-determining and you're not a victim. So when we're talking about your story, I don't do story very much in our training. I don't like story. I think story keeps you in prison, in prison of the past. I want you to be more of a pioneer than a prisoner. And I don't know about you, but I love and really enjoying this journey of self-awareness and personal power with you. I'm enjoying immensely sharing with you these principles, these codes, and the ways of being that I trust it will not only be useful to you, but again, you can replicate it, this knowledge, and pass it on to those who are special in your life. So remember, everything you want is on the other side of fear. Everything you want is on the other side of fear. So that's it. That's it for tonight. I've gone way over. I do apologize. I hope you're all still there. Let's just have a little look and see where we're at. Yeah, you're all still there. So thank you for being here. I'm going to stop the recording now. So I'm going to stop recording.